Central Time. I'm Rob Farah. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a children's clinical psychologist tells us how to have a helpful and productive conversation with our kids about school shootings following the most recent shooting in Uvalde, Texas. First, supply chain issues in the U.S. and around the world are improving in some ways, still struggling in others. From toilet paper to lumber and from simple products to complex microchips, one good after another has been hit by supply chain problems over the last couple of years. There are a lot of reasons behind that. Pandemic shutdowns, back and forth swings in demand, bottlenecks in the global shipping and transportation worlds. But our next guest says there's a fundamental problem. The global supply chain is built on a model that makes it super vulnerable to any kind of disruption. He says it all highlights a need for better supply chain regulation in the United States. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you still experiencing supply chain disruptions in your life, in your workplace? If you work in the shipping industry, what are you seeing? If you drive a truck, what is that like right now? If you run a business, have you been affected by the broken supply chain? Are you having trouble getting the stuff you need? If you are a builder this summer, what are things costing right now, those key materials? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. David Dan is the executive editor of The American Prospect. He's the author of books including Monopolized Life in the Age of Corporate Power and Chain of Title, How Three Ordinary Americans Uncovered Wall Street's Great Foreclosure Fraud. David, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Before we start digging into the details, and there are lots of details, in some of the stuff you've written about this lately, you say we've just built this supply chain that is super vulnerable to disruptions. How is it working, or I guess not working?
Well, I mean, over the last 40 years, we have constructed a system of commerce that is built for efficiency over resiliency. And efficiency has come to mean cheap. It's kind of a euphemism for cheap. Make sure you can find the cheapest labor you can. Make sure you can find a production facility that requires you to spend the least on environmental remediation, things like that. Make sure your shipping logistics is very cheap so that you can transport those goods. Make sure you're getting goods from the warehouse or from the facility, from the shipping port directly to the store, so you don't have a lot of inventory. It's known as just-in-time logistics. You only order as much as you need at that moment. That's cheaper. And so what that does is it introduces hidden risk into the system. And during the pandemic, we saw how this risk exploded.
What were some of the biggest things that threw a wrench into that just-in-time system?
Well, obviously, when you have production localized in one part of the world, in this case, China, any disruptions to that production system ends up magnifying. When you had increased demand for goods over services because everybody was sitting at home in the pandemic, not going to bars or restaurants, you had bottlenecks arise in the shipping infrastructure. In our port system, a lot of these mega ships can only be serviced by a handful of ports. About 40% of all imports come through the ports of Los Angeles and Long Beach in the United States. And a recent global survey of port efficiency put LA and Long Beach dead last in 2021. And this is the port that we rely on the most for smooth transfer of goods from overseas into stores. There were other bottlenecks from trucking to rail for a variety of reasons, deregulation, investor preferences to reduce capacity, again, for cost reasons. This all created breakdowns in the system.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. James is with us in Green Bay. James, hi.
Hi, and thanks for taking my call. So I'm a truck driver. I'm an hourly local truck driver. Most of the stuff that we consume, moves on over-the-road trucks, guys who get paid by the mileage, I wouldn't go back to that. That stinks. We get pushed too hard. We work 14-hour days, which ain't so bad if you're working 3 days a week and get some home time. But nobody wants to do that 6 days a week anymore. The old guys who are okay doing it, they all retired early because of COVID. You can't get young people to do that. No one wants to work 60 hours a week, never see their family. No one at all wants to work 70 hours a week and then have to do your reset in some other state 500 miles from home. It's just hard to get new truckers. And because there's not new truckers, they're pushing us even harder to make up for the shortage, which is a short-term solution that's inevitably going to exacerbate the problem.
James, thanks a lot for the call. David.
Yeah, I mean, I would argue that we don't have a shortage of truckers so much as we have a shortage of good trucking jobs. 450,000 people get their CDL licenses every year. The problem is there's massive turnover in this industry for a lot of the reasons that the caller described. It's just not as good a job as it was before deregulation in the late 1970s and in 1980 under the Carter administration. And, you know, there's the problem is even worse with respect to port truckers who are often misclassified as independent contractors who, you know, there are problems with are they paid by the mile rather than the hour, as the caller mentioned. In port situations, because they're misclassified, they don't get a minimum wage, they don't get certain benefits and protections, they have to lease their own rigs, often from the company that dictates their employment. There are a whole host of problems with trucking, and a lot of it stems from the deregulation of the system back in 1980.
James, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Elizabeth joins us now in Neenah. Elizabeth, hello.
Hi. I am originally from El Paso, Texas, and when I lived there, there was quite a bit of manufacturing accomplished. The initial materials were produced in the United States, but then sent to Mexico right across the border to be assembled and then brought back in. And I know that quite a bit of that has diminished as manufacturing shifted to Asia. But I'm wondering if maybe a lot of manufacturing or at least assembly might move back to our continent in order to minimize that. I mean, essentially, you can then rely on trucking rather than just shipping.
Elizabeth, thanks for the call. David, is this happening?
It's a great point. I think because of the uncertainty created by supply shortages, by just not knowing when you order goods, whether they're going to be shipped on time, that we are starting to see, both in policymakers and among the business community, this desire to do more onshoring, to do more nearshoring, like bringing goods into Mexico rather than getting them in China for the production. And then there's been this concept talked about by Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen and others about friendshoring. In other words, making sure production is in companies or countries with which we have a good relationship. Obviously, one of the biggest problems right now with respect to the supply chain is the reduction in energy supplies because so many of them came from Russia. And obviously, we banned oil imports from Russia after the Ukraine war, and energy prices have skyrocketed. And of course, energy prices factor into the cost of virtually every good that is transported in the United States. So that's another concept that's been talked about. I think there are definitely, certainly for critical goods, there is a strong case to be made. There's a bill right now in Congress. On the House side, it's called the Competes Act. On the Senate side, it's called the U.S. Innovation and Competition Act. That one version of it would give billions of dollars in supply chain resilience funding to reshore those kinds of critical goods, things like medical supplies, things like semiconductor chips, and the like.
Elizabeth, thanks for that call. We are talking about the supply chain, how to manage it, how to regulate it, with David Dayan, executive editor of the American Prospect. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is this affecting you in what you buy, in what you make and or sell at your workplace? What questions do you have about the supply chain problems, their impact on inflation? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with David Dan, executive editor of the American Prospect, looking at supply chain problems still going on. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your ideas, your questions, your experiences. David, in some of your recent writing, you've looked at something you call the bullwhip effect, leading to absences of products and then gluts of said products. What is happening there?
Yeah, so essentially the point is this: when you're a retailer and you order a bunch of goods, you have to essentially guess at the expectation of whether there will be enough customers to buy those goods by the time they get there. Because once you order them, they have to be manufactured, they have to be shipped, and they have to be brought to your store. So there's been a high demand over the last several months, particularly for physical goods rather than services. But a combination of the Federal Reserve raising interest rates and trying to reduce demand, and also the shift back to services and away from goods, has created, at least in some products, less demand. The problem is that these retailers have already bought those goods and they're having them shipped. So you go from shortage to glut, and it's kind of like a bullwhip because there's time that it takes to cock that whip and have it, you know, repeat back. So that's what we're seeing in some places. Target has talked about this, and some other big box stores have talked about now suddenly they have a glut in certain items, and there might be clearance sales over the next couple months. So this is a common thing that happens in logistics because it just takes an amount of time to get goods shipped and delivered, and there's always the opportunity of demand falling off or rising.
Let's get back on the oceans now. Congress has actually been trying to tackle some kind of regulation of the transoceanic shipping industry as it comes into the United States. What is in the works? How might it help?
Well, it's sorely needed. I mean, you have an ocean shipping industry that in 2021 made as much money as they did in the previous 10 years combined. And in the first quarter of 2022, they announced $59.8 billion in profits. It's a highly concentrated industry. There are essentially three ocean alliances that do the bulk of ocean shipping throughout the world. They have raised prices significantly. They're also charging a number of fees that many cargo owners have said are unfair. U.S. regulators do not have a lot of good authorities to actually make sure that there's fair dealing in this industry and that people aren't being price gouged. So there's a bill called the Ocean Shipping Reform Act. It passed with a whopping, I believe it was over 350 votes in the House by voice vote in the Senate. And so it's passed both houses pretty easily. That bill that I mentioned before, this competes U.S. Innovation and Competition Act, that ocean shipping bill got folded into it. And so if and when that passes, it's in a conference committee right now between the House and Senate. When that passes, the ocean shipping bill will probably be passed with it. And it gives a lot more authority to the Federal Maritime Commission and other regulators to, you know, crack down on unfair contracts, to look into these exorbitant fees, sometimes which are placed on cargo owners to get their cargo off ports, even though it's buried under 20 shipping containers and they can't get to it. It would be, I think, an important inflation fighting tool to re-regulate this industry. It would kind of be one of the first re-regulations of an industry in America in decades.
Big picture, you're hoping for, I think, a lot more of that kind of action, right? More active steps by the U.S. government to keep the supply chain flowing more smoothly?
Absolutely. And, you know, a lot of this will assist in the long term, But I think it's important that we not get caught short again, because pandemics aren't the only disruption that can really wreak havoc on the supply chain. We're seeing it right now with the war in Ukraine and what that's done to energy and also food prices. Ukraine is a big producer of wheat, for example. Anything can cause...
I think we lost you there, David. Are you still there? Well, I think we just have a minute or so left, so we'll wrap it up there. Thanks to our guest today, David Dayan, executive editor of the American Prospect magazine. He joined us today looking at how the shipping, manufacturing, and retail industries are responding to ongoing fluctuations in supply and demand. If you have more experiences to share, heard a great experience and a great question there, you can always email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Of Wisconsin's 600 historical markers, just 7 commemorate the history of the state's Black and African American residents. The Wisconsin Historical Society is working to change that now by adding about 40 markers recognizing the history of Black and other marginalized communities. As Diane Bazooka reports, one of the first new markers will highlight a southern Wisconsin lake town that was a safe haven for Black families from across the Midwest.
6 miles east of Lake Geneva is a small subdivision nestled beside a quiet lake, Lake Ivanhoe. Peter Baker first visited in the 1960s. He was 9 years old, and his friend brought him up from Chicago on a fishing trip.
I bet we caught over 70, 100 fish, bluegills and crappies, and it was the most exciting and life-changing thing for me. So we went home, and I ran in the house with all these fish, and I showed my mother. We were up there in Lake Ivanhoe, and it was all Black. And the first thing she said is to my father, Ernest, we're going up there next week.
The Bakers bought a house on Tuskegee Drive and moved the family up from Chicago. During the era of sundown towns where African Americans were not welcome after dark, he says Lake Ivanhoe was a refuge.
This was about as safe as life could get up here. Because we literally could sit in the middle of the roads at nighttime and watch the stars and talk and play. The freedom was unbelievable.
Baker later learned that was the whole idea when the community was dreamed up a century ago as the first Black-founded development in Wisconsin. In the wake of nationwide race riots, African American leaders from Chicago bought the land in the 1920s to build a Black resort town.
It was an immediate hit, drawing families from across the region and performances at a central pavilion by acts like Cab Calloway. But the stock market crash in 1929 brought it all to an end. Following World War II, families like the Bakers rediscovered Lake Ivanhoe and slowly made it a year-round community. Baker eventually built his own home and raised his family here. Now he's president of the Lake Ivanhoe Homeowners Association.
This is our clubhouse right here. It was a much smaller place.
But he says things have changed. Now the community is mostly white and Hispanic. African Americans are only about 10% of the population.
The lake needs dredging, the road needs repair, and the history of Lake Ivanhoe is fading.
That's why Baker has been working on getting a historical marker. In recent years, he's been getting help from Katie Green.
Have you ever seen this?
Are these guys fishing on Lake Ivanhoe?
Yes, ice fishing. Look at this here.
Green has spent summers in Lake Geneva since the 70s, but she had never heard of Lake Ivanhoe until a few years ago when a friend's grandmother mentioned it.
I had asked all my friends that I grew up with in Lake Geneva. I asked all my current neighbors, have you heard of Ivanhoe? Nope, nope, nobody that I knew. So I started to dig into it.
That's how she met Baker. Now she and Baker often spend their Saturdays combing through old documents and newspapers.
Carol and Billy Cross? Do you?
They're trying to connect with past residents. One of the people they found was Janet Alexander Davis, who came to Lake Ivanhoe in the 50s on family fishing trips.
One time I caught what they call a dogfish. That was the ugliest fish I've ever seen. Ugly and big. But I was so proud of that fish.
She hasn't been back since childhood, but she's excited about the marker.
It's proof that we were treated differently in this society and continue to be. That we had to find our own way and have our own things because we couldn't just go where we wanted to go, to shop, to live, or to buy. So what I felt there was free.
Baker's planning a dedication ceremony for the new marker.
He wants to invite past residents, have a pig roast and big band music, like the old days.
I plan on being here for a long time, hopefully for the rest of my life. And I just hope it's always a place that African Americans can feel safe in. I literally am at peace here.
And he believes recognizing the community is the best way to ensure future generations find refuge there, too.
Diane Bazuka, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up after the news, have you had difficulty talking with your children or maybe your students, if you're a teacher, about the Uvalde, Texas shooting or school shootings in general? A clinical psychologist will help us begin those conversations and help work through emotions that your child may be experiencing as they deal with this news. We'll find out how to talk about these things at different age levels as well. If you have a question, maybe from your own family, maybe from your own classroom, you could share it right now. Email ideas@wpr.org. And we've got a couple open conversations going on over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Earlier this week, we asked you to share your favorite games, board games, card games, you name it. A bunch of you shared really great stories. You can keep sharing those, and we can put those on the air in future episodes. And a conversation about one of today's topics, the long history of Star Trek, the little show that kept going and going and going and is now creating new series to this day. We want to hear your Star Trek favorites, your memories, what got you into the show or what turned you away from it, a favorite era, a favorite character while you're at it. Let us know over on the Ideas Network Facebook page or email ideas@wpr.org. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, set your phasers to listen. Our guest explores the evolution of the Star Trek TV and movie franchise and how its fan culture set the example for all fan cultures. Now, following the deadly school shooting in Uvalde, Texas last week, families are faced with talking to their children about the school shooting and school safety. Talking about the shooting can be difficult for anyone. Talking about it with kids who might be learning about these types of tragedies for the first time can be even harder. A children's clinical psychologist talks with us today about how to navigate these conversations and what behavioral changes to look out for. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is this you? Are you a parent trying to figure out how to talk to your kid, if to talk to your kid about school shootings? What's been the hardest thing for you? Was your kid the first to approach you? Did you bring it up with them? If you're a teacher at any level, how do you talk to your students? What do they ask you about this kind of news? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Karen Rogers is a clinical psychologist at Children's Hospital Los Angeles. She's an associate professor of clinical pediatrics at the Keck School of Medicine at the University of Southern California. Karen, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
I think one concern parents might have is whether they should talk about these issues at all, if they're just potentially reinforcing fear for the kids by bringing it up. Can you make the case that for many age levels, we do need to have these conversations?
Absolutely. For most age of children, this is something that they've heard about. They've learned it from media or from their peers. And they may have a lot of questions and misinformation that parents can help clear up. And equally importantly, it's very helpful to children to have those conversations with the people who are closest to them and who they trust to take care of them and keep them safe.
I imagine things are going to be very different depending on the age level. But one principle that comes from the National Center for School Crisis and Bereavement at Children's Hospital Los Angeles is that honesty is the best way to talk to our kids about something like a school shooting. Why is that?
Yes. Well, it has to do with trust. You know, a parent or a teacher is a trusted adult in a child's life, and children look to those adults to help them understand and make sense of the world. And you're building a long-term trusting relationship when you have a relationship of honesty with your child, which doesn't mean giving them all kinds of details that they're not prepared to hear, but also not distorting the information that you give to them to, you know, make it sound like it's not a serious problem.
Suppose a child doesn't come to the parent asking about a school shooting or wanting to talk about it. How can a parent figure out that on-ramp into that conversation?
Yeah, it's important for parents to begin this conversation when children don't bring it up. You know, children also often want to protect their parents by avoiding talking about things that they think may be difficult. And children may have seen their parents' emotional reaction in the last week to this terrible news. So it is important for parents to be willing to bring it up. And I find it can be helpful to open that conversation by asking children kind of as experts about kids their age, kids in first grade, kids in middle school. What are they talking about and wondering about what happened?
Let's now move to the earliest end of the age range, kids who might be in preschool or maybe kindergarten, first grade. What are some of the things that we can say to them? What are kind of some of the things we can talk about with them at that age-appropriate level?
Even for preschoolers and kindergartners, it is important to bring this up. Children hear from, if they don't hear from their peers, you know, they hear from older brothers and sisters, and it can be very confusing for young children who don't have life experience to understand something like this. So it is important for adults to open this conversation with children and give them a very brief explanation. You know, there was a terrible thing that happened. A bad person went into a school and hurt many people. And have you heard about that? And what questions do you have? It's helpful to know how to steer a conversation by really letting the child lead with their questions. What is it that you've heard? What is it that you're wondering about? What are you thinking and feeling about this?
When is it right for a parent to say, you know, in response to those questions, I don't know?
Whenever that's the honest answer, I don't know. There are many things about this that we don't know. We don't know how this could happen. We don't know, you know, what led this person to do the things that he did. And we still don't know a lot about exactly what happened. It's important not to give the I don't know answer when children are asking for reassurance. You know, am I safe at school? I think children need to be reassured that they're safe at school, that their teachers and all the adults around them do things every day to make sure that children stay safe. And that while bad things do happen sometimes, those things don't happen very often. They're very, very rare.
Karen Rogers is with us, clinical psychologist at Children's Hospital Los Angeles. We're talking about how to talk about school shootings with kids of different age levels. You can join in at 800-642-1234 if you have an experience to share in having this conversation. How did it go? If you have questions about how to talk to your own kid, or maybe if you work in a school, maybe your students. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Karen, kids, of course, may be disturbed by hearing about this news, but may not be able to express that well what it is that's bothering them. What are things that parents can watch for as warning signs that, hey, maybe they need a little more reassurance?
I think it depends somewhat on the child's age. Young children, when they are confronted with something really stressful or traumatic, often show changes in their behavior. Particularly, they can show what we call developmental regression. That means that a child stops doing things that they were able to do before the stress. They may talk more in baby talk or prefer to play in ways that they played when they were younger. And they can lose other developmental skills like toilet training. So those are signs that a child is experiencing a lot of stress. I would also say a significant change in the child's behavior would be something to watch for. You know, children who are more withdrawn or more irritable or more sad or more clingy, particularly maybe showing signs of increased stress. And then for older children, similarly, you may notice changes in behavior. You may notice more withdrawal, and you may notice more mood changes as well.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Rebecca is with us in Manitowoc. Rebecca, hi.
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my call. I was just listening to the program, and as a parent, I do have two kids in high school and college, so I've been through this whole school shooting thing their whole lives and had to talk to them many times about it. I remember 10 years ago when Sandy Hook happened, and they were both in grade school, and the shock and the horror and my kids not wanting to go to school the next day, and me saying exactly what your guest is saying to say, which is it's rare and it's really unlikely to happen. And now 10 years later, I don't believe those words anymore. And I don't think it's responsible to tell our kids that it's rare, because it's not rare. It's actually becoming common. And I really think that we need to discuss what we really need to be telling them, and that is how to protect themselves. And I know it's sad and scary and horrible to think of that we have to teach our children that, but we need to have discussions about what to do if something like that happens, not, oh, don't worry, it's rare. Yeah.
Rebecca, thanks for the call. And Karen, I know, I mean, statistically, we know most kids won't go through a school shooting, but I mean, I've been there as a parent too. I'm trying to convey a sense of safety to a kid, but I'm worried at the same time, just like Rebecca is.
Yes, absolutely. I think as parents, this is a very distressing thing for us to contemplate, that, you know, we now can count, not on two hands, the number of school shootings that we've experienced in this country. It does remain rare, and it seems to be a growing problem that we are confronted with. I would encourage parents who are feeling particularly frustrated or upset at the pace of school shootings to do what they need to do to take care of their own feelings, and then also to think about how to get involved. What can I do as a parent to make my community and our country safer for children at school?
Rebecca, thanks a lot for calling in. We're talking to Karen Rogers, clinical psychologist at Children's Hospital Los Angeles, associate professor of clinical pediatrics at the University of Southern California, with us to talk about school shootings with kids following the most recent mass school shooting in Uvalde, Texas last week. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you had a conversation with your kid at some point about school shootings? Have you had that conversation in this last week? What questions do you have about how to answer kids' questions, about how to bring these things up? If you've talked about this in your school, if you're a teacher or work at a school, love to hear how you approach this as well. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk now with Karen Rogers, a clinical psychologist at Children's Hospital Los Angeles, with us with some advice on talking to kids about school shootings. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have specific concerns when you're having a conversation with your kid about school shootings that you want to bring up with our guest? Do you have an experience to share having this conversation? Or if you grew up in the last 20 years or so, how did your parents talk to you about these things? What's happening in your schools? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Karen, our caller Rebecca mentioned that, you know, after Sandy Hook, her kids were reluctant to go to school the next day. How do you handle that kind of conversation?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think, children often have a difficulty taking perspective about how nearby and how frequent these kinds of events are, and feel like it's a more immediate threat to them because of the way that they experience you know, the media coverage, for example, of what happens. And so, again, talking with children about what their specific concerns are is a really important first step. They may be worried about different things than you think. And so asking the questions about what is it that makes you feel like you don't want to go to school today? What in particular are you worried about? Can we make a plan to help you stay safe? You know, how can we stay connected while you're at school and I'm elsewhere so that you know that you have my support available to you to help you with this difficult day?
Now, I think a lot of grownups are familiar with the experience when something horrible happens of over following it, exposing ourselves maybe too much via social media or radio or TV or whatever. Can you talk about how to make sure a kid gets a break, if especially if they're of an age where they are on things like social media?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Older children often control their own exposure to media now with personal computers and tablets and cell phones. And so it's not as easy for parents to limit that exposure as it is for younger children, where the parents may have more control over their devices and their access. But engaging in a conversation with older teens about the choices that they're making in their media consumption and the impact that it might have. And, you know, being open as an adult, I personally felt like I needed to turn off the coverage for a little while and give myself a break. How about you? Like, what are you feeling about that? What's your experience? You know, sometimes I find I get pulled into reading, you know, or looking at one thing after another about a terrible event that has happened. And it doesn't help me feel better. It makes me feel worse. So I plan breaks. And maybe that's something we could do as a family, to plan to turn off all devices and spend some time talking together or playing a game or going somewhere and being together.
And how about, you know, information gained on, depending on the age, the playground or on the street, monitoring what kind of messages kids are hearing from their peers, some of which might not be rock solid information?
That's right. Yeah. So children who don't get information from trusted adults are getting information somewhere, and that information may not be accurate. This is why it can be really helpful to ask questions like, oh, what are kids in your class talking about? What are you hearing about this? What do you know about what happened? And what other questions do you have? And then when there's a misunderstanding, really providing them with more accurate information.
Let's go back to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Jane is with us in Madison. Jane, hi.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
What did you want to tell us about, Jane?
Well, my youngest son is starting his first year in teaching in the fall. So now my concern has moved from him as a student to him as a teacher. Same fear of a shooting in a school, but different now.
And Jane, first of all, did you talk to your son about, you know, Sandy Hook and the shootings that happened when he was, what, in middle school or high school?
We did, yes. Yes, absolutely.
Well, Jane, thank you for sharing that. Again, this is maybe more toward the parent side of concern there. What thoughts do you have for Jane as her son starts a career in teaching, Karen?
Yeah, you know, we never used to think that a career in teaching would mean putting yourself in danger. And when an event like this happens, it brings to the forefront our awareness that it's not 100% safe, as nothing that we do is 100% safe. So, you know, having that sort of broader perspective can be very helpful in reminding yourself that, you know, driving to work may be more dangerous than being in a classroom, for example. Statistically speaking. And then also, you know, I think your son is making a really important contribution as a teacher, you know, dedicating his career to this field, and a courageous one in an era of school shootings. And like other parents whose children choose careers that may put them sometimes in danger, that can be very, like, difficult to you know, just kind of live with that possibility, and yet also a source of pride in your child and your family and the values that you have shared.
Thanks for that call, Jane. We'll go next to Joe with us in Madison. Hi, Joe.
Hey, Rob. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, what did you want to tell us about, Joe?
I guess our own experience at home, our youngest daughter, when she was in middle school a few years ago, she was, I can't remember the school shooting at the time, but she was questioning, you know, if something was to happen at her school. And she said, well, what if I'm in the bathroom at the time, Dad? What do I do? And I'm like, it's a good question. I said, you know, get on top of the toilet, open up the stall door, and be very quiet. You know, I said, make it look like it's empty. I said, I know it's going to be very hard to be quiet, but you need to be quiet. So if the shooter tends to, you know, looks in the bathroom, he'll see it looks like it's empty because the doors are open and nobody, he can't see any legs. But it was scary to talk about that. I mean, you would assume that going to school is safe, but we know now that it's maybe not as safe as we think it is all the time.
Joe, thanks for the call. Karen, answering kids' questions about actual safety procedures in the event that hopefully still unlikely event of a school shooting.
Yeah, I think that the caller's response to his child, giving her concrete, tangible things that she could plan to do, is a really nice way of reassuring her. Feeling like you have the possibility of control when a situation feels like it can be out of control, feeling like you're prepared and you have a plan of what to do, can really help alleviate anxiety for children as well as for adults. So I think that was a really helpful response.
Thanks a lot for sharing that experience, Joe, with us at 800-642-1234. Karen, there are likely some teachers or school administrators out there. Do you have thoughts on dealing with some of these issues in group settings when they come up in the classroom, especially for those younger ages in particular?
Yeah, I think, you know, teachers have a good gauge of how to talk to children, the children in their classroom, like the developmental level and the type of language and the way to frame things. And it can be really helpful for children to have an opportunity to air those, their questions and concerns within a group of their peers with a supportive adult helping them to manage that conversation. And so I think for teachers to provide that opportunity, when it's warranted for kids, just to talk about what they've heard and what questions they have and how they're feeling about it. It's also an opportunity for teachers to help identify a child who might be struggling more with anxiety in the wake of this event.
What kind of resources out there are there for parents or educators, for that matter, to help them have these kind of conversations? I know you at Children's Hospital Los Angeles have a lot online.
Yes, we do. And the National Center for Crisis and Bereavement in Schools has a guide for talking to children when an event like this happens. So I think that there are some nice resources available online. And then if a parent is looking for, you know, more guidance or help, maybe talking with their child's teacher about how things are going for their child at school and what kinds of things they've talked about in the classroom. Talking with other parents they know, a pastor or somebody in their church community who can help them come to this conversation with a, you know, grounding in their faith and their value system also can be helpful.
In just our last minute or so, Karen, can you leave us with just a bit of encouragement for that parent who thinks, I really should be having this conversation, I really don't want to have this conversation?
Yeah, it's very hard to open up a difficult conversation with a child. And I think it's important for parents to remember that it doesn't have to be an extended conversation. But the fact that you're willing to bring up difficult topics with your child tells them something about how they can trust you and what your relationship is like. And so you're helping them in the immediate moment, but you're also building your relationship for the long term.
Karen, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today. That was Karen Rogers, clinical psychologist at Children's Hospital Los Angeles and an associate professor of clinical pediatrics at the Keck School of Medicine at the University of Southern California. She shared advice on talking with your child about school shootings, especially following the shooting in Uvalde, Texas last week. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, get a look at the power of prosecutors in Wisconsin's criminal justice system and what happens when that power is misused, with cases from northeastern Wisconsin as part of the central focus. We'll get more from the WPR and Wisconsin Watch podcast, Open and Shut. And you can follow that podcast. Head over to WPR.org. Check out every episode of Open and Shut, plus the latest edition of the Mapped Out podcast. That's tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Coming up in just a few minutes, we'll get the inside story of Star Trek, or Star Treks, with the author of a new book on the history of the series, from the earliest concept to the brand new shows coming out this year. And along the way, we're hoping to hear your Star Trek story. Are you now, or have you ever been a fan of the show? Do you have a favorite series or episode or movie? Is there a particular character you've connected with? Have you shared the show with the next generation? And has the show been part of your social life? Let us know right now over on the Ideas Network Facebook page, or you can email ideas@wpr.org. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.